Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 43-plus years. Every Sunday night, we sit in front of our radios, and we inform each other, teach each other, learn from each other, and hopefully entertain each other. So I am thankful for everyone coming back here this Sunday night when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual link. Okay, if you need to reach me via email, there are two email addresses available. One is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The other is roy@limarktech.net. That would be either for mailbag questions, if you can't reach us during the technical net and you still have a question for us, or a comment. Also, if you have a topic that you would like to hear discussed or be part of a discussion or be the discussor. Or if you have a technical puzzle, we're always looking for technical puzzles, so that's the reason. Or if you would like to for me to contact Paul and give him a link to something that you've seen either YouTube or website about space and NASA and want to hear his opinion, you can email him directly at spacenetreport@gmail.com. In addition, I have links available to all kinds of interesting articles on YouTube that I've seen and collected over the last week. You can get there by typing into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limarktech.net. And also, we have a chat room available. It's been quiet lately. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limarktech.net. And, of course, we maintain a internet audio stream of the technical net and Glen Oaks repeater the rest of the week. You get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limarktech.net. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. He has a million visitors, making a million in one. Let me drop, and I'll tell you what I got planned for tonight. There are two subjects I want to mention at the beginning of the technical net about the ARRL and some funny business, perhaps. And maybe some closing comments about the Consumer Electronics Show that was this past week. After that, I will call for questions or comments or topics for discussion. As per always, we would prefer you to ask questions or topics that are amateur radio related at the very beginning, but as time goes on, we're open to any discussion of any science and technology. We'll try to wing it and do the best that we can. That should take us to approximately 10:15. We will turn it over to Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report. That should take us to approximately 11 p.m. And I will return to tie a bow on things and wish you well for the following week. So if the laws of thermodynamics and electrodynamics and such continue to work the way they're supposed to, and my radio and my computer and such don't malfunction, that's the plan. I will let it drop, and then I will start with my first topic for tonight. My first topic is about going on with the ARRL. There's an attempt to change one of the bylaws. I think it's designated Bylaw 46th Amendment, which apparently is going to introduce a significant degree of non-transparency into the board. It will allow the board to do things without bothering to tell the members. The defense that the people are giving me is the board kind of thinks that the board should protect the board as opposed to the members of the organization, you and me, that pay those now exorbitant dues and exorbitant payments for magazines that used to be included in the dues. So some funny business is afoot. And I will be posting a YouTube. It's called ARRL Sworn to Secrecy, Part 1. That's on my link pages. In addition, I have a PDF that I just found from a member of the board who is unhappy with Bylaw 46. So if anyone has any comments, I realize this is kind of early. So a lot of you probably haven't even heard of Bylaw 46 Amendment. If anyone has any comments, please feel free. Is that push to talk?
ADCDU.
Yes, Alex.
What are we worried they're not going to be transparent about? Like, sell the spectrum behind our back? Or, like, where the funds are being allocated? Or what's the concern?
Well, I don't think they're going to sell the frequency allocations because, thankfully, a lot of our frequency allocations aren't really enticing to commercial interests. Cell tower, the telecommunications industry wants microwaves. They really don't want HF band. But the second thing you mentioned is a very likely thing. They have kind of jumped up the price of membership to the ARRL. And they're not really interested in explaining what they're going to do with all the money. I don't think they're going to do much in the way of extra spectrum allocation business. Matter of fact, one of the things that they're interested in doing is completely tabling the HOA bills that they were very, very interested in doing, you know, 7 years ago. And so they want to save money on that. So it's going to be less money spent lobbying and more money spent doing something. But thanks to Bylaw 46 Amendment, we may never know exactly what that extra stuff is. And then you're always kind of wondering, you know, what kind of little bonuses do they give each other and such. So, I think transparency is a good thing generally. I think when a group of people get together and try to cloudy up the issue, that usually doesn't bode well for the rest of us.
I definitely agree with you about the transparency. Do you know how are they incorporating? I mean, is it a not-for-profit that has to make public disclosures about where the finances go? Like, that's why not-for-profit ratings exist. Are their tax returns public?
Theoretically, I believe it is a 501c, so it is a not-for-profit organization, and accountants can probably explain how you can really obfuscate where you're spending the money. There's all kinds of curious ways of describing kickbacks to directors and vice presidents and presidents, if you really want to. So on a theoretical basis, yes, they're a 501c, and it's supposed to be public. But, you know, how much is kind of hidden in the teeny tiny writing? I don't know.
Are they transparent about where the lobbying money goes, if not the operational fund? ADCDU.
I don't know for sure. I would certainly hope so, because most of the mail that I get from them is the Spectrum Defense Fund, although I have no idea what they might be doing with the Spectrum Defense Fund. I haven't heard. In the old days with the HOA bill, there was a lot of talk of who was promoting it and who was blocking it and who was contesting things. I haven't heard diddly squat other than requests to write a check to them for the Spectrum Defense Fund.
there's no one else in the game, right? There's not like a second lobbying organization in Defense Spectrum, is there?
As far as amateur radio operators, no. It's the ARRL, and that's it. All the other organizations out there are more focused on emergency services or volunteer examining and other such things. But as far as defense of our spectrum, the only organization I'm aware of is the ARRL at this time.
It sounds like I can get the pitchfork out. I think I agree with you. CDU,
hopefully. Okay, very good. As I said, I will be posting a PDF with a little bit more of, in the terms of explanation. In the link pages, you'll see ARRL Sworn to Secrecy Part 1. That's an interesting video. It features Rhea and 2RJ. Who used to be our section director, I think it was called. She was kind of eased out. I think the excuse was that she had written a book on taking the VE exams, and that was her reason for being cast out. Also, I think some of the guys in the main office weren't thrilled with her. So it's BL-46. Just Google the transparency, ARRL. They've done it before, and the results were that a slate of directors were thrown out and replaced with people who were against that. So they're just, I guess, trying again. So it's BL-46. Google away and make up your own minds. But if you're concerned, contact your section director. Hell, contact everyone in the ARRL you got email for, and tell them that you're unhappy. I know I'm unhappy. I'm unhappy with the dues raising. I'm unhappy with the magazine extra subscription price. I'm unhappy with the fact that it went into effect January 1st for me instead of waiting until the end of the year that I was paid up for. But, you know, that's just me. So, you guys think for yourselves and do for yourselves, and I'm sure you'll decide to do the right thing. Okay, I guess there's no other comments, so I'll move to my second topic, a short one. This past week, we had the Consumer Electronics Show, which is a very weird thing that takes place every year in January in Las Vegas. A lot of weird things, I guess, take place in Las Vegas. For the most part, they showed a lot of television, because, you know, that's what they tend to do these days, show a lot of television. Big televisions, transparent televisions, organic light-emitting diode televisions, mini LED televisions, all kinds of televisions. And some of these things will never actually be sold because the cost for production on some of them is something ridiculous like $100,000. It's just to show off the high-end technology, you know, unless you're Elon Musk or some other billionaire. So there wasn't really that much exciting as far as I was aware. They showed some cars that no one will ever be able to buy because, yes, it's just a technology showcase. And a lot of very strange little gadgets and little robots. And, of course, everyone and their brother mentioned artificial intelligence. Apparently, that's the code word for anything interesting for the next year, artificial intelligence or AI. So I've mentioned before that I'm expecting cereals to feature AI aspects to their Fruit Loops and Corn Flakes any day now. So that's my slightly view of the Consumer Electronics Show. They did, as I kind of suggested, they're promoting brighter screens. They have quoted screens capable of as bright as 5,000 nits, which is probably guaranteed to cause your eyeballs to bleed if you stare at it like staring at the sun. So that's my little comment of CES. Anyone with any responses or replies to that? Okay, I will take that as a no thank you. We now move on to the regular portion of the Limark Technical Net, which is questions, comments, topics of discussion. If you're out there and you have a question or a comment or a topic, please hit that push to talk, give me your first name and your call sign, and whether it's a question or a topic or a comment, and try to be first few related to amateur radio, and we'll certainly open the subject to every aspect of science and technology as the night progresses.
Easy.
Rich recognized. By the way, I think our Echo Link is down. I haven't been able to connect myself, and I've been kind of monitoring if anyone else is connected to Echo Link, and they haven't. I've emailed Lou and our guardian angel, NY2H, and maybe it just needs to be kicked in the sides and rebooted. So we may not hear from Echo Link tonight, depending upon whether or not it can get rebooted or just spontaneously heal. Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list tonight?
AD2DU.
Alex recognized. Anyone else wish to put their name down on the list tonight? Very well. We will start with two, and hopefully as the night progresses, we'll get a few more questions or comments. Rich, what's your question for tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Roy, and everybody else who's listening. Way back in the ancient days of ham radio, circa 1961, when I was a NOS, the two most used coaxes were RG-58 and RG-58U and RG-8. Fast forward to 2024, those cables are sort of deemed to be not efficient enough. And I wonder what has changed in that time. I could understand for UHF and VHF, but for HF, why isn't, let's say, for a run of 30 feet, why isn't RG-8 good enough? And could you also explain velocity factor and why we care about velocity factor? So those are my two questions, Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll take the second one first because it's a lot easier and shorter. Almost no one cares about velocity factor. It doesn't really introduce any qualitative feature in being an amateur radio operator. It's important if you're using things that require knowing what a quarter wave and a half wave length on a piece of transmission line, because as the velocity factor determines the correction of the length. In other words, if you had a coax cable that had a velocity factor of 1, then a half wave in space and a half wave in that theoretical transmission line would be the exact same length, because real coax cables have a lower than 1 velocity factor. In other words, the energy is transferred at slower than the speed of light in a vacuum. You have to correct the change in the physical length of the transmission line if you are building quarter wave, half wave stubs and such. So that's the primary importance. You're not going to build stubs and other such using a transmission line if velocity factor is meaningless. If also, and this is very rare, but it's a little bit less rare these days, We've talked about vector network analyzers. We've talked that they have something called a time delay reflectometry, which is basically it's kind of like an echo. You send a signal across your transmission line, and you listen for reflect signals back. Those occur at impedance mismatches or at the end of the transmission line. And you could use it to actually measure your transmission line if it's not connected to anything, because it bounces back. And depending upon the velocity factor, you can easily input that into your VNA, and it will tell you how many feet long your transmission line is. So that's the major important suitability factor. So let me make sure that I got that down for you before I move on to the next part.
Yeah, I understand, Roy.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, one of the earliest was RG-8 and RG-58, and I think probably around the same time, RG-8X came into existence as kind of a compromise between the two. RG-8 was go-to HF transmission line out of World War II. We've talked about this before. Coaxial cable as a device was known long before amateur radio operators used them. Before World War II, coaxial cables were not really massively manufactured. They were very expensive, and amateur radio operators tend not to like expensive technology, and so open line wires was the way that almost all hams used transmission lines prior to World War II. When we got out of World War II, there was a lot of Army surplus, and one of the things that the Army had invested in a lot was miles and miles of coaxial cables, primarily, I would assume, RG-8. That was, I think, started as a military designation. Suddenly you had this well-isolated transmission line. You didn't have to worry if there were conductors nearby. And because it was Army surplus, it was cheap. And again, hams love cheap. So they bought a lot of RG-8 and such. And they needed some smaller, more flexible stuff to just kind of get by for short length. So RG-58, the compromised RG-8X. But over time, you know, everyone tries to reinvent the wheel. And Micro Times technology reinvented the wheel with the famous LMR 400. They did a few interesting things, which included the double braid. They had a copper braid, and then they shielded it with aluminum foil. And the design of LMR 400 has a slightly better attenuation loss than the old RG-8. And it tends to be somewhat sturdy. And RG-8 is kind of a commodity at this point. Anyone and their mother could manufacture things and call it RG-8. But theoretically, you can't really call something LMR 400 unless you're Times Microwave. People have gotten around it, but it's still, some people like the best. Even though it might be a wee bit overkill for the HF band, they tend to just kind of settle for it for everything, like I basically have done. I use it for my HF, which isn't that important, but I also use it for my VHF and my UHF, which is more important. So I'd rather have just kind of one brand and just have a big roll of it and cut it and put terminals on it and be done with, rather than have some that I use RG-8 and others RG-8X, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you turn it back to me, Roy?
Yes.
All right, what determines the rating of coax? Because can't you get cheap RG-8 from China and a much higher quality, let's say Belden or whatever manufacturer, in the United States. So what differentiates between cheap coax and the more expensive stuff?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. One important thing is consistency. It's all well and good if some runs of a Chinese coax cable manufacturer are good, but if that alternates with the occasional terrible run, then you have an inconsistent quality. So quality assurance is an important thing. American manufacturers tend to be a little anal retentive, and they're more consistent. Chinese less so, and also it's very possible that different manufacturers will ship under different names. You're never quite sure whose product you're getting. The most infamous of stories I can give you is that of a Radio Shack a few decades ago. Radio Shack, of course, never really manufactured their own stuff. They were just guys in the middle. They would find a manufacturer, they would agree upon a price, have it branded real thick, and shipped it out. But just as easily, they would change from one distributor to another distributor to another distributor, from another manufacturer to another manufacturer. And so there was once upon a time a Radio Shack coaxial cable that someone showed me that they slipped the insulator to expose the braided outer shielding. And gosh, they really saved a copper. I mean, it wasn't really anything close to a solid knit of a braid. It was more of a kind of a couple of loose small gauge copper wires kind of snaking up above the insulator below the insulating cover of the coax. So you can go cheap on the copper. It'll look reasonably well from the outside. It's kind of difficult to tell what the braiding looks like, but it'll have terrible isolation. It'll have terrible attenuation loss. It'll be awful.
I've seen, in fact, I've bought coax that the braid was woven, but there were such spaces between the weaves of the braid, it was ridiculous. Now, the importance of the center conductor, I guess, of course, LMR 400, the diameter of the center conductor is much bigger than that of RG58. But who cares? Why would the, let me put it this way, why would the components of LMR 400 so outperform RG58U as it became known as an RG8X? First there was RG8, then came RG8X. But you have the inner conductor, you have the dielectric, you have the braid, and you have the outer casing. When you make those bigger, why is that more efficient?
Well, I mean, there's two things that come to mind. One is the power handling capacity. That a bigger, thicker wire obviously can handle much more current than a smaller one. So you might burn out an RG58 if you run full legal under some circumstances, whereas with something either an RG8 or an LMR 400, you're far less likely. They take a massive amount of current. The other is the attenuation loss. It's just the nature of the beast that the more resistive a conductor is, the more you will find that per 100 feet, given a certain frequency, there will be more decibels loss in attenuation loss. One of the beautiful features of LMR 400 is that it's doubly shielded. It has a very nice tight copper grade, and on top of that is an aluminum foil coating so that it has better shielding, and so it has somewhat better attenuation loss than the single shielded RG8. Matter of fact, cable companies, if you take a look at their high-end cable, Dick, K2RIW, may rest in peace, used to regularly tell us how he had cut a great deal with the small amount of coax cable on their spools, you know, only 500 or 600 feet that they really didn't want and wanted to get rid of. And so he said for a 75 impedance transmission line that's very useful on cable transmission lines because it was quad shielded. So it had great, beautiful attenuation loss numbers.
Can you measure the quality of coax?
Well, again, it depends upon what you mean by quality. If it's just mechanical sturdiness and consistency, I don't know of any single test. It's more of your history with a product. You can measure attenuation loss. You can send the test signal into 100 feet of something and measure the output power and calculate the number of decibels of attenuation loss, or you can extrapolate them from other lengths. So attenuation loss is relatively easy to measure. And some people it's important, and other people, they're blissfully unaware. Every so often, you'll bump into some very nice new guy who has 150 feet of RG58 running onto a UHF antenna, and they wonder why they're not really connecting with anyone.
It seems to me that making a decision whether to go with RG8 or LMR400 is just a judgment call. There's no way of really knowing how much better one will perform over the other, correct? So it's just guesswork.
I wouldn't really call it guesswork. I think it's more of a case of overkill. You kind of know what you're getting with both. A good quality RG8 versus any kind of, you know, God knows what it is. Then it's Russian roulette. But assuming you have a good quality RG8 versus a good regular brand LMR400, you kind of know that theoretically you should be getting more power to your antenna given the length of your transmission line. But it might be overkill. It might be cost ineffective. You know, if you're going to get an increase of about, 10 watts out of a 1,000-watt transmission, and it's going to cost you twice the price for the transmission line, a lot of people would say that that's overkill. So the guys who know how things work sort of know what choosing a different coax will mean. Whether it's practically, financially reasonable, or if it's just kind of, I want a gold-plated toilet in action. You know, you have to decide for yourself.
And why is a thicker cable more important with UHF and VHF than HF?
Well, by the way, there was, I think, someone doubling, so we'll give him a chance in a moment. You're going to have the big problem with transmission lines is attenuation loss. The reason why you'll never see people hooking up coax cables to microwave transmitters is because as you increase the frequency, any given transmission line is going to have greater and greater attenuation loss, to the point that when you're operating in the microwave spectrum, you're not going to use a coaxial cable. You'll use a waveguide, which is much more efficient but works somewhat differently than a coax cable. So the big problem with the skinny, flexible, inexpensive cable is that a lot of your power is dissipated on the way up. It doesn't make it to the antenna, and so you're wasting a lot of the output. And one of the factors that contributes is the amount of surface metal. It's not the total volume because of the skin effect, and that's why LMR 400 Flex, which is more flexible because it doesn't have a solid center core, it has a bunch of stranded wires wrapped around each other. But because it's stranded wires wrapped around each other, the skin effect has a slightly higher resistance, and the attenuation loss for LMR 400 Flex is a little bit higher. Let me ask, is there a person who I think tried to break into the conversation? Do you want to transmit your ID?
That was me, Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I doubled. Yeah, I was just going to talk about the RG8 and the RG8U. You know, when I got involved in, the mid-1980s, one of the hams that was giving me the novice test, he says, you know, he had a piece of coax with him, RG8, and he says, don't get this. It has the foam style. Make sure you get the better one. I said, which one is that? And he says, the RG8U, it has the PVC, you know, the plastic as a dielectric. Because there's a little bit more loss with the RG8U, but most important thing is, because of the foam, you tend to get moisture, it absorbs moisture. And some people have had failures with getting too much moisture inside the coax. And, that's what I bought. And, you know, I'm still using that stuff today. It never went out. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, okay, that's good to hear. Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things used as the central, the dielectric material. In some, there's just a kind of coiled-up plastic, and most of the dielectric is there. Those are famous for filling up with water. Then if you have a foam type of dielectric, there's open foam which can soak up moisture. You really want something that's either closed foam or solid plastic material, so you don't have to concern yourself with one of the failure modes of a coaxial cable.
Wait, none of this has to do with SWR, right? You'll get the same SWR reading whether you're using LMR 400 or RG58.
Some of my HF wires, I wound up with 59 instead of 58 because, it was, 59 was used for TV coax. So somebody had that and they gave me a whole bunch of that. And it works, but you don't have to be that critical on HF, but definitely on VHF and UHF, I highly recommend the better, like RG8U. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, Dick swore by his quad-shielded 75-ohm cable television transmission line.
I remember that, yeah. He says, hook it up, it'll work.
Yeah, those were great stories, how he found these guys, and the spool was only, 5% full, a couple hundred feet, and they just wanted to get rid of it. So, in some of the stories, it sounded like they just gave it to him, and others, he gave them a couple of bucks, and they spent they gave it to him, and so those are the great stories. Getting back to, you doubled with Rich, so let me answer Rich. usually, as long as there's no real quality issues, there's no inconsistencies with impedance, because that can happen. A low-quality transmission line may not be consistently 50 ohms from one end to the other. But as long as it's consistent impedance and such, it's not a matter of SWRs or anything. It's more frequency range due to attenuation loss issues and power handling capacity. You don't want to heat up your coax, especially if it's low quality and given to kind of burning up on you.
Okay. I think I got the picture now. Let me see if there's anything else about coax. I don't know if you answered this already and I just wasn't listening, or you didn't answer it. Why is it more important to get the thicker stuff for UHF and VHF?
Again, it's a matter of attenuation loss. If you are connecting it to 5 or 10 feet away, you know, I wouldn't suggest your antenna be that close to you. It's a moot point. If you're going to kind of, circle it around your roof and it's something like 75 or 100 feet, these things, especially on UHF, you can have 4, 5, 6 dB of loss just on the transmission line alone. That's terrible.
Yeah, so I guess the rule is get the biggest cable that you can afford.
Again, it depends upon your attitude. You don't want to have to change your transmission line if that's the only problem. I mean, if the antenna dies, then so be it. But the worst thing that you could do is kind of design your transmission line for 100 watts, and then one day someone gives you a linear amplifier, and you're scampering up the roof to change the transmission line. I mean, it takes all kinds. There, I know a guy who decided when he was setting up his UHF-VHF system to use hard line because he thought that hard line would offer him a longer life. These things do have a non-infinite lifespan, and so he invested in much more expensive hard line, which also required special hard line connectors, and when they go bad, it caused some problems, but he decided that he would go that extra mile. Most of us would not. Most of us, I there's very few people I know other than him who are using hardline transmission. They're using coaxes, a couple cases. There's open wire, but for the most part, it's coaxes of different expense. Sometimes you get a good deal in a Chinese LMR 400 knockoff, and you play Russian roulette, and sometimes you win.
You know, thinking about it, I guess the outer jacket is important, the quality of it, for weatherproofing. Because you have a crappy outer jacket, a thin outer jacket, and it's blowing in the wind, it may crack. So I guess that's a consideration also, just purely for weather.
Yes, that's an important aspect as well as manufacture. Is how durable? Is it UV protected? Because a lot of the coax is going to be exposed to UV. So you'd hate to have something that kind of degrades over time. There are special coaxes that are designed to be exceptionally durable and variable. There's a burial version of LMR 400 that has a much tougher outer coating so that you can bury it in the soil and not have to worry about any problems under those circumstances as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a physical object and it has mechanical stresses and all kinds of things could go terribly, terribly wrong over time. You know, one of the things that kind of age coaxial cables, UV, weather changes, water exposure and what have you.
Yeah. Boy, I wonder what an LMR per foot costs these days. It's a buck something, right? Probably. Anyway, you've answered all my questions. I have a much clearer idea of what's going on with coax. And I'll turn it back to you, Roy. This is W2BZ.
Okay, very good, Rich. Always a pleasure. I appreciate you participating in this technical net experience. Yeah, LMR 400, last time I looked, it depends where you buy it from, under what circumstances. It's usually a little bit more than a dollar a foot. You could probably find it for $1.10 a foot. You could find questionable companies more than happy to take $1.50 a foot. But usually they include some particular service along with that. So, I've been using LMR 400. I like it. It's consistent. It's a little bit expensive, but I don't think I'm going to be changing it too quickly. And I'd rather, once I can somehow get an antenna put up, I like to leave it alone as long as humanly possible. So I thank you, Rich, for participating. If anyone else has any comments about this subject, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
KD2BHT.
Yes, Jim.
Good evening. Coming in with the conversation late tonight, but I was wondering, is there any commentary on the smaller coaxes for portable HF setups? I think there's one or two very small coaxes. Are they usable, or are they just silly to try?
Again, it depends on the application. Most of the time, unless you're making short connections, the attenuation loss is going to murder you. The places I have seen them best used, in my experiences, have been so-called...
Cut out the end of that, Roy.
Yeah, I'll be back, Jim. Sometimes he has a problem with also.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay, I should be back. It's weird. There's a window on my computer, and it decided to shrink itself down and put itself in an obscure place, and I couldn't get to it for a little while. What I was saying was that they make good pigtails. In other words, if you have an SMA connection on your handy talkie and you want to hook it up to a chunkier coax, so you'll have a short length of very, very thin pigtail cable, and that'll feed to a UHF connector that feeds to a proper larger diameter coax.
So you're not too keen on using it for a feed line itself?
Again, if you're doing it for a couple of feet, it's fine. If you're doing it for 50 feet, I would urge against such things, especially when you get the UHF and such. You can look up the attenuation loss on these coax cables. They're all over the place.
Roger, thank you. Back tonight.
Okie doke. Thank you. Anyone else with any comments on this subject before we move on?
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
Just a question on velocity factor. Is that directly related to the owl of the copper?
No, it's more a function of the dielectric constant of the insulator.
I see. Thank
You're welcome. Any other comments before we move on? Feel free. Hit that push to talk. Okay, that takes us to our next person, Alex, AD2DU. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
So I bought a 100 milliamp hour power clean LiFePO4 battery, and I bought a 2,000 watt inverter, thinking that I can eventually have a solar generator set up, but at least be able to power radios with it and power backup stuff in the house. What, like, danger-wise do I need to say? I've never handled a large battery before. What should I not do? AD2DU.
Well, I guess the most important thing is don't short the damn thing. It depends upon how the battery is designed. Most of the... what kind of a battery is it? Is it a lithium iron phosphate, or is it some other variation of lithium?
Yeah, it's one of the LiFePO4 batteries. I think it's, you know, otherwise used as a trolling motor.
Okay, I have two lithium iron phosphate batteries. They need to have chargers that are kind of designed for them. If you use lead acid charging stations, you know, I mean, you might charge it, but you probably are going to shorten its life expectancy. They're pretty much always multi-cell, and they have load balancing circuits built in the case, and they have overpower safety circuits very often. If you try and draw too much all of a sudden, if you short it out, sometimes the safety circuits will kill the battery connection, and you'll have to put it back on a charger to reset that safety feature. The most important thing with any high-capacity batteries is don't short them. You know, make sure that you're putting them to a proper load with a proper resistance. You don't want to start a fire, although lithium iron phosphate is a lot more forgiving than the lithium ion and lithium polymer types of batteries.
I mean, you screw and unscrew the terminals with your hands, right? Just don't do both at once.
Yes, I wouldn't do both of them at once. I mean, hopefully you have sufficient resistance that, you know, 13.8 volt potential difference is not going to kill you. You know, we're not really talking about high voltage here, but still, it's always good to have proper practice. Don't find yourself with two hands on each of the two terminals.
You know, like, about what 100 amp hours can power? Like, that's not, can it put a refrigerator? Or, like, I don't know how much power that is in a practical sense.
Well, all you do is it's something like a 13.8 volt battery. So multiply that by 100, and that gives you the amount of watt in 1 hour. And then figure out how many watts your refrigerator does. And what it amounts to is it will power a refrigerator with the proper inverter, but for less than an hour. Not a question of whether or not it will do it. It's sort of a question of how long it will do it, because the amp hour is the charge capacity in the battery, how much energy it can hold on to without kind of losing itself. And that's the only amount you can supply to the inverter that then feeds your refrigerator. Unfortunately, you have to keep in mind that these ratings for rechargeable batteries or batteries in general are often more marketing ploys than anything else. The amount of amp hours you get out of a battery is incredibly dependent upon the rate of drawing the power. Most of the time, these higher ratings, like 100 amp hours, is related to a very slow discharge of your battery. As you increase the rate of the discharge, you decrease the amount of power that you can extract. A lot of it gets lost as waste heat. So that 100 amp hours is best case scenario. If you have something that draws a lot of current, you will end up extracting a lot less than 100 hours.
If I'm using the inverter on it and something plugged into the inverter, do I need to have a power measurement device or a voltmeter or something to tell me when the battery is going to be depleted, or will it just shut off when it's done and then out of power?
Well, I mean, you can run a voltmeter on it, and when you see that the voltage is dropping, it's a good indicator. Otherwise, it really depends upon the design of the inverter. Some inverters have some indication when battery power will soon be failing, and others are blissfully uninterested in that. So you could either get a more expensive inverter that has a voltmeter and indicators along that lines, or you can jury-rig your own voltmeter to see what the voltage output of your battery is becoming as time goes on. As time goes on and you bleed it of its power, all batteries will decrease their voltage output. Lead acid is infamous for it. You could take a lead acid fully charged at about 13.8 and half discharge, it'll be 11. Lithium iron phosphate is a lot more forgiving. It has a much flatter decline. It goes, the voltage drops much more slowly than lead acids do. And then when they fail big.
What do you mean by when it fails big? A lithium iron phosphate fails big?
Well, I mean by that what a battery is supposed to do, supply power. It'll just kind of, it'll drop down to 6 volts, and whatever it is you're feeding into it will say, no, I'm not taking that. And so, you know, it's just a dead battery until you recharge it again. Nothing particularly dangerous. All batteries, if you draw out too much power, their voltage just keeps going down, down, down.
Yeah, I was worried you were going to say the failure state is it lights on fire. But I think you can string these things together, too, for a bigger battery bank. And I don't know why I have an obsession with the power. The power never goes out here. But I want to be able to run stuff when it dies. I'll test it out. It sounds like it's not going to hurt myself too bad. I got a special charger that charges it. I need to make a inertia power pull in for that charger. Turn that to run the house down. AD2DU.
AC2GS, yes. It's always good to keep the house from burning down. I don't know. It's somewhat problematic connecting separate batteries to each other. Internally, the cells, as I mentioned before, have circuits that load balance. Because if you don't have circuits that sense the charge of each cell and adjust the charging current for each cell, you tend to have cells that are drawing more power than they should, and they overheat, and it could lead to problems. So unless there are special circuits in the totality